Blog Talk Radio.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice, fair use, successful crowdfunding, how to ask for music rights, and what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com. Hi, and welcome to The Art of Film Funding. I'm your co-host, Claire Papin, along with Carol Dean, author of the best-selling book, The Art of Film Funding. Carol is also the founder and president of From the Heart Productions and the host of this show. And our guest, Sam DeLucas, has been coloring movie images for 25 years for feature films, episodic television, commercials, and music videos, and counts every major Hollywood studio among his clients. He's a member of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences and a champion of independent filmmakers. Very glad to have you with us, Sam. Carol, I understand that Sam is also a winner of the Roy Dean Film Grant, right?
Yes, he is, and he's been a major supporter of the grant, and he also donates his time, Claire. Sam judges the fall grant for us and has for years. So welcome to the show, Sam.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes, and I wanted all of our listeners to know that Sam loves to work on docs and independent films, and I can't tell you how many great compliments I've heard about his work from satisfied filmmakers, and I want you to know I highly recommend him. So I really wanted to start with the basics. So what does a colorist do, and why are they so important, Sam?
Well, besides just fixing technical problems, which is what a lot of people think that colorists do, we're also, or can be, a vital part of the storytelling process. Color and exposure really sets a mood for your film. And so what I like to do is sit down with filmmakers and talk about story beats and about individual scenes and what they mean in terms of the overall story picture, and then look at various examples of what we can do with the imagery to help further that process. And there are so many different choices that you can make in terms of color and exposure for your movie. It doesn't have to look ordinary. It can look extraordinary. And that's what I love doing, especially with independent filmmakers who are maybe going through the process for the first time. A lot of people are intimidated by walking to a color suite. They kind of understand what sound mixing is, and of course they understand what editing is, but sometimes color can be a bit of a mystery to them, and sometimes people are intimidated because they don't have the language set that they think they need to talk about it, and they don't need to worry about any of that. They just need to come in and tell me their story, and I'll interpret what they're telling me and show them pictures, and they say yes or no, and it's like going to the optometrist. You say, better or worse, and you make choices that way.
Oh, great. Well, speaking of language, let's go back and tell me, what do you mean when you say story beats?
Well, whether you're doing a documentary or whether you're doing a dramatic film or whether you're doing a comedy, there's going to be changes in tone over the course of your story. And color can augment that process, can it augment that experience for the viewer, just like you would insert music to help promote a certain sense of mood for a given scene. Same thing with color. You might want to take something that's very serious and make it darker, desaturate it, make it cooler, and then something that's supposed to promote happiness or hope or something like that, you know, the obvious choice is to do the opposite, is to make it bright and sunny. And then there are, you know, millions of subtle choices that you can make that can give your show a really unique and polished look. And that's the other thing. If people are familiar with what mastering is when it comes to music, making an album, a CD, that's another part of what I do is color mastering. So I take every frame and try to get as much information and as much detail and as much pop as I can out of it within the confines of telling the story in terms of a color palette. But a lot of times people think, oh, I just got like a couple of bad shots and the rest of the show is fine, and then they see what a real colorist can do with their work, and they had no idea that there was that much information and that their picture could look that great.
Yes, I bet they are shocked. Well, let me ask you, when you talk about setting moods, what comes to mind is a winter bone. I mean, I actually was cold watching
that.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, you really feel it in that movie. It's a wonderful example of that, of not having a lot of warm tones, and the snow was, you know, slightly blue, and the sky was slightly blue-gray, and everybody's face looked kind of washed out, and, you know, your shoulders went up around your neck to keep you warm.
Yes. So they got the feeling they wanted out of that. And then last year, Meryl Streep did that, what, Osage film, where
right.
they were
August
all in one house,
yeah.
And that had a feel to it, right?
Right, yeah, it had that lush, you know, that you almost felt the humidity in the air in that movie, you know.
Yes.
Rich colors and the warmth and stuff. Those are perfect examples. And because everybody's finishing their films digitally now, this technology and this range of possibility in terms of what your movie looks like is available to everybody, regardless of whether you're working on a $100 million studio picture or you're working on, you know, a $10,000 documentary.
Really?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
even if you
yeah.
have a low-budget film, you can still work with your colorist to get the mood you want in the film.
Absolutely, absolutely. There are a bunch of different levels that people can work at. I work at a more professional level, but there are certainly tools that filmmakers can avail themselves of that are available on a desktop or even on a laptop that could help their imagery. And for people that can't afford someone like me, I encourage them to dive in and try those programs themselves and see what they can do. You can certainly get yourself in trouble and make your picture look worse, so you have to play around with it. But there, you know, there's some great tools out there, and it's with everything else, with desktop editing, with inexpensive cameras. There's this great democratization that's happened in the filmmaking process, and so we're getting, you know, some great work from people that have never tried it before.
Oh, I love that idea. Well, how does the colorist know the mood of the film? Do you read the script, or do you have a discussion with the director? How do you find out what it is they want?
Well, what I like to do is the first thing I'll do to decide if I'm right for a project is I'll ask the director to send me a DVD or a file of the picture in progress, and hopefully it's pretty close to final cut. A lot of times they're still shooting, or they're still, you know, maybe if it's a documentary, they've got a couple more interviews that they've got to get. But the basic bones of the structure are there, and I can take a look, and I can see how much work is going to be involved, and that helps me to make a bid, financially to them. But it also tells me, you know, if this is something that I want to take on, and I start to get ideas about how the footage can be affected in terms of color to help tell the story that the filmmaker is trying to tell. Then when it comes down to actually working, when picture is locked, then I'll get a full resolution copy, I'll put it into my system, and I'll sit down with the director, and we'll take a look at the whole movie and try different things, and we'll sort of discuss the story beats and the mood, and we'll make a palette. We'll create a palette. We'll take like a hero shot from each scene and color that and say, okay, this is kind of the basic idea that we're talking about. And that's the way that I like to work. It, for somebody that's not used to the process, it can be fairly tedious. It's like watching paint dry for some people. So if they can just sit down and watch their movie, and hopefully they can with me, then we talk about the story beats and the mood for each scene. We'll set specific looks for each of those scenes. The filmmaker will go away. I'll work on it for a week or two. They'll come back and take another look and see it all realized for the entire picture. And then we go through a series of notes, you know, if they've got changes that they want to make. But it's really just a discussion with the filmmaker. I have sometimes worked with people that can't sit down with me in the same room. Maybe they're out of town and we're sending files back and forth. And that works as well, as long as I can have a discussion with them and they can see the big picture of what they're trying to tell, then we can work out, a series of ideas.
Yes, with Skype and phones and conference calls, most of my people are in L.A., and I don't drive down, and they seldom drive up. We work electronically and stay off the highway, so I can see you working all over the country like this.
Yeah, I just worked on a project that was shot in Memphis called Meanwhile in Memphis, The Sound of a Revolution, and it's a documentary about the Memphis music scene post-Elvis and post-Stax Records and what happened since that time in Memphis, and there's been a vibrant music scene going. Well, the filmmaker couldn't sit with me, so he sent me a full-length movie on a hard drive, and I loaded it into my system. And then, yeah, I got on the phone with him. And I said, "Let's go through this, and let's talk through every scene and what you feel about it." And then I made I would do like a two or three shot sequence from each of those scenes, and I sent that back to him via email because those files are fairly small. And he said yes or no to those ideas, and that's the way that we worked. And it worked out just fine, you know. It was delivered on time, and it's gotten some great notice. They've won some awards. So the fact that you can send files, through the Internet or big files, you can just mail a hard drive, has made it so much easier for filmmakers to get a professional colorist to work on their work, even if they're not in L.A. or New York.
Yes. I think that's the most important thing. Well, what I'd like to learn and for our listeners to learn today is how to get to post with a good product. And I know that you often say that many problems can be solved with communication. So do you think that filmmakers should hire their colorist early in production?
I do. I think that you should make choices about your colorist and your mixer and your graphics people early in the process, not once you've got everything shot. Ideally, you want to talk to those people before you shoot one frame. The reason being that there's so many choices. These cameras that are out there now are amazing, and they've got so many possibilities for making beautiful images and recording great sound. But there are also pitfalls. There are things that you can do that are really a terrible mistake to make just in ways that you set up the camera that can really cause expensive problems down the road and sometimes problems that are very difficult to repair. So by getting your post-production team involved early, just have a roundtable discussion with your colorist and your editor and your mixer and your graphics folks. And talk about what are we going to deliver, and then given that, what do we need to set the cameras at? Sitting down for an hour can save you thousands and thousands of dollars down the road. I had a person the other day. They brought me some footage. They had to cover an event. It was basically like a corporate party. And they hired this person to shoot it on red camera for them, and they had two red cameras. And because these cameras could, the DP just decided, well, I'll give them the best possible thing I can. So the cameras were set to 5K at 48 frames. Well, that's a tremendous amount of data. Nothing was in real time. And there were terabytes and terabytes of data that we had to wrangle, and the poor filmmaker's editing system wouldn't even handle that level of data. Just because the cameras can do something doesn't mean it's particularly right for your project. They weren't shooting Avatar. He was doing like basically a corporate film, So he had to down-res all that high-resolution imagery into something that his editing system could process before he could even start working on it.
Okay, so sometimes too many buttons can spoil the broth, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of some of these cameras out there. But if you don't know what you're doing with the camera, don't make assumptions. Really, talk to people who are going to have to deal with this stuff down the road. And they'll tell you, because no one wants to deal with these with technical issues that are going to eat up a lot of time. What they want to do is the creative work to help you tell your story. We're all part of the storytelling process, you know, editors, mixers, sound designers. But, you know, if we're spending half our time converting files that were given to us improperly, then we're out of the creative process and we're just being technicians.
Yes. Well, I find people use this phrase too often. That is, oh, we'll fix it in post. We'll fix it in post. It doesn't matter. But what they're doing is just running up a huge bill in post, and exactly what you're talking about, because I was watching some takes for a man, and I said, it's interesting that every time you set the camera up, you know, the head is framed in a different place, and when you start editing these together, it shows up. He said, no, we'll fix this in post. And I thought, man, that's got to be expensive.
Yeah, and, you know, and time-consuming, at least time-consuming. So reframing, everybody does reframing to a small extent. You know, if you've got something... You got a window that you want to get rid of, or there's a, you know, the boom mic comes in and something like that. You might fix a couple of shots, but you don't want to just make this broad assumption that you can fix everything in post for every single shot. It's just terribly time consuming. It eats up a lot of the work of the time that you could be doing more creative work that's helping your project. If that's the case, you might as well just lock the camera off, you know, put it in auto mode, and say, we're going to reframe it and fix the exposure later. But what a nightmare, you know. That's just, just because you can do things doesn't mean that you should. And the idea of fixing it in post is always an expensive process. It's better to get it right on set, always.
So hiring a colorist early on, discussing the camera you're using, and questioning any buttons that you might think would benefit you with the colorist can really be a good way to handle or to work with your colorist to get the proper knowledge so you know that you're ending up with a good product, right?
Yeah, you know, and I wish more people would do that. I wish more filmmakers would approach me at the beginning of their shoot. It doesn't happen as often as I would wish. And so a lot of times projects do come to me after they're edited, and that's fine. I mean, I'll take the work, and I love working with filmmakers no matter what. But you know, I don't know how other people do it, but I don't really charge for those initial meetings. I just want to help people get the right information in front of them so that they make the right choices during their shoot so that when they get down to post-production, they're not wasting money. They're making it better, not just making it acceptable.
Good. Oh, that's so kind of you. Well, let me know about the DaVinci. I know that once it was the gold standard in color correction. Is that still the case?
Well, yeah, I worked on a DaVinci 2K for over a decade, and before that, other DaVinci products, and they were all great. But at some point, they sort of ran out of steam once we started approaching an all-file-based workflow. They couldn't really handle the amount of number crunching that was required. So I started looking for another system. DaVinci still has a system out there called Resolve. There's a bunch of them out there in the workplace. I chose a Baselight. I'm on a Baselight 2, which is the same platform that all the Harry Potter movies were colored on. The movie Hugo was colored on it. It's a very powerful software and hardware platform that's specifically designed for doing this kind of work. And it's really fast, and it deals with all these high-resolution cameras very easily. And I love it. There's other platforms out there. There's Luster. There's Nucoda. There's a bunch of different gadgets. They all do sort of the same thing. Some do certain things better than others. But what you're really looking for is a colorist, not a box. So, you know, if somebody's just trying to sell you on the fact that they have a certain box, it has to look at their work, you know. But, Da Vinci was, they were the king, and they still do a great job with their Resolve product, but there's a lot of other options out there now.
Right. Well, you've just brought up something really important. When you go to hire a colorist, what questions can you ask? Because most of us are so not so knowledgeable in this area. What questions do you ask someone to find out if they are capable or how talented they are?
Well, ask what they work on, and you know, just because somebody does one sort of work as their you know, bread and butter doesn't mean that they can't do other kinds of work. But I mean, I really like working with independent filmmakers and documentarians. That's something that I get a real charge out of. I do TV commercials as my day job. That's how I pay the bills, and they are one sort of workflow and one sort of idea about what color is. But I also like telling longer stories. So working with especially nonfiction film for me is it's almost like recreational color because it's so different than what I do in this little 30-second world. You know, the thing is, it's all about communication. You have to have a rapport with the person you're working with, and you have to know that they understand your sensibility about your project and that they understand the story that you're trying to tell. And it's like anything else. I mean, there are great editors. There's great mixers out there that are just not for everybody. It's a personality thing as well as, you know, once you start talking to someone, you know whether they know what they're talking about or not.
Yes.
I do encourage filmmakers to seek out somebody who is a professional, who is seasoned, though, not somebody who's necessarily, like, trying out the software for the first time in their setup in their spare bedroom. You know, I mean, I work on a Dolby professional monitor. It's a $40,000 monitor. That's crucial to know what you're looking at, to know that you've got a calibrated monitor so that you can trust the images that you're looking at, because all the choices that you're making are based on what your eyes are seeing. You wouldn't want to go to a mixer that's, you know, monitoring your mix through a jam box, right? Well, the same
yes.
thing. You don't want necessarily somebody coloring your movie on a laptop computer.
Yeah, but you can see everything on that monitor, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's what it's good for. It points out when things look great. It also points out whenever there's issues, whether it's a camera issue or a color issue or an editing issue. You see everything, and you want to. You want to know where there's problems so you can address them.
Well, Sam, tell me about 3D. Is that an option for makers of independent docs?
Aye. It is and it isn't. I mean, there's cameras out there that will shoot 3D for you. Mercy, it's so slow. I mean, a lot of people make the incorrect assumption that, you know, doing post in 3D is going to take twice as much time and twice as much money because there's two eyes. It really takes about 6 to 8 times as much money and time because there are so many things that have to happen. You color one eye, and then you have to match the other eye to it. Then you have to fix geometry problems between the two cameras, and then you have to do the stereo separation, you know. So each one of those processes is like going through the film another time. So it's not just like coloring it once. Unless you've got a really deep budget for post-production, you know, you have to ask yourself, is 3D really going to improve the story that I'm trying to tell? I know that there's some corporate work and like military work and stuff that's happening in 3D right now. That's pretty cool, but they have the budget to do it. The filmmakers that are coming to you to help them with funding are probably outside of that possibility. You know,
mm-hmm.
3D is interesting. It's not my cup of tea for storytelling. And I have certainly worked on it. It just takes a long time in post. Yeah, figure at least like 6 times longer than what you would spend on a single eye production.
Absolutely. Well, tell us what's going on with you right now and what exciting films you're working on.
Oh, well, like I said, I just finished up the Meanwhile in Memphis project, which I'm very proud of, and it's been winning some awards. And in my day job, I'm working on a feature film that was actually shot on 35 and looks beautiful. And it's so great to see a studio picture that's shot on film. They're becoming sadly rarer and rarer. But that's an interesting challenge because a lot of the infrastructure for shooting on film has kind of gone away. You know, there's fewer labs, there's fewer people that'll do film to tape transfer in Los Angeles. So it's a skill set that is sadly drying up. But I love the imagery. You know, there's nothing like looking at stuff that's shot on color negative.
I know. Well, who's developing now? I didn't know there was anybody left to develop 35.
Well, Photochem is still working, and I guess there are some, you know, Technicolor still has some labs out there. The other day there was an article that came out about these few filmmakers in Los Angeles that want to put some money into helping Kodak keep their production line up and running. But I just wonder, you know, if that's going to really work because you can't just like turn that thing on once a month and make some film. I mean, you've got to keep people employed that know those very specific skill sets and keep that equipment running and clean. And, you know, if they're talking about this, just these small batches to do one film every 3 months or something, you know, sadly, that medium may be going away, you know, sooner than later. I sure do love it, though.
I know. I love it too. Well, it supported me for 33 years, for which I'm so thankful.
Exactly.
I hate to see it disappear. But I know, because they took me to Rochester one time. Kodak took me back there, Sam, because they had gone into the video business, if you can imagine. They put their videotape in yellow boxes, and I said, oh, my gosh, we have to talk marketing. So I took Magritte and Escher books, and they had just done a whole 100,000 or some ungodly number of a brochure that had six images of TV sets on it. And so I said, oh, you know, I think this is old hat. Why don't we look at something new? And so, you know what? They threw all that stuff away and they changed. They used a lot of Magritte's concepts.
Mm-hmm.
They really jumped into the world, but they also threw out video and decided to stick with what they knew. But I know that very few people that worked at Kodak ever got into the emulsion room where they actually laid the emulsion onto the Rostock.
That's got to be a handful of people that know how that works at all.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so how old are they? Where are they? And... yeah, because those are the technicians. They made it work because you expect a little bit of a color shift from one dye vat to the other, one emulsion number to the other. But when you start having major shifts, that's not acceptable. So it's up to those technicians who knew how to do that. I mean, they were very special people, weren't they?
Yeah, real scientists who really cared about making images as beautiful as they could possibly make them. Very committed folks. It's a shame. But, you know, we live in this world where we have these amazing digital cameras and people can do wonderful work. And like I said, the filmmaking process is very democratic now. You can get a damn good camera for not too much money, you know, but you've got to make the right choices about how to set it up. And that's really crucial. I encourage any filmmakers who are, you know, about to start a project to get in touch with me, samdcolor@gmail.com. That'll reach me, and we can talk about your project, and I'd be happy to talk you through the process of getting in and out of the color suite and make recommendations for you.
Oh, thank you so much for that, Sam. We really, really appreciate that. And what about people who are raising money on Indiegogo, but to get the money to make their doc or feature? They definitely should be contacting you, right?
Yeah, and, you know, that's another thing that I like to offer independents, is I'm happy to, color your Indiegogo or your Kickstarter campaign. gratis, you know, in the hopes that you'll use me to color your feature. I don't mind. It's, you know, it's a 2-minute piece, and it allows me to meet new filmmakers, which I always love, and we can discuss some of these issues, and maybe I can, you know, save them some heartache down the road by giving them some good, solid advice. But that's something that I do offer independent filmmakers who are trying to raise money online. You know, bring me your trailer before you put it up on Indiegogo, and let me just do a quick color pass on it and make it really shine, you know, and by sweetening your picture and making it look professional, people are going to believe that you can do the work that you say you're going to do. And I'm happy to provide that for people.
Thank you so much. What a great gesture. Really appreciate that. And Sam, we're starting to get applications now for the Roy Dean Fall Grant. That's the one that you and Michael and Lee will be judging in the fall.
Terrific. That's always a great time.
I know, and I really appreciate the heart you put into this, because filmmakers will say to me, you know, he called me, and he asked me some tough questions. And I think that is wonderful, Sam. You take such a personal interest, and you guys have been choosing the right winners. The film you chose last year, Elizabeth Scher won for her film Penny, mm-hmm. which is about a gay lawyer who's an activist, and also has been investing in women's art for years and giving everything back to the community. They had their premiere just last week, Sam.
Fantastic. That's so great. That's so great to
and
see.
And it was a great seller. So I have to get you a copy of that film. You will be very proud of it.
Well, you know, Carol, I mean, it all comes back around to you. You have been such a friend to independent filmmakers for so long and really care about people telling their stories. And I know you bend over backwards all the time to help people. And the books that you got out and the seminars that you do and all the help that people can get from the Heart Productions is just so crucial. The people that are kind of lost about the funding process. And I think, you know, you really give people hope. You help them believe in themselves. That they can make their project, and it's just so encouraging to see projects come through, you know, that are in the infancy, and then, you know, a couple years later, there they are, you know, premiering, and we've all had a hand at, you know, helping these filmmakers
yes.
along. Yeah,
we've
it's
all
gratifying.
Been able to help and nurture and support each other. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, it's great.
It's great. Well, thank you for the time, Sam, and for the information, the education. So it's samdcolor@gmail.com.
That's correct, yes. Please, please contact me. I'd love to work on your film.
Okay. We'll make sure they do. Thank you so much, Claire, for hosting the show.
Oh, yes. It's an honor and a pleasure. Thank you again, Sam and Carol. As always, a wonderful interview.
My pleasure. Certainly.
Okay, take care, Sam. Bye.
Be well. Bye-bye.
Be well.
I want to remind our listeners that David Raiklin is a brilliant and talented award-winning musician who scores films and can compose music for a trio or for a full orchestra. David is a very good friend to the independent filmmaker and comes highly recommended by From the Heart Productions. If you need music to help tell your story, please contact him at davidraiklin.com. That's David, RAIKLEN.com. And Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at fromtheheartproductions.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good luck with your films, everyone.